Okay, we're very happy to welcome Yehui Quek from Stanford University, who will tell us about quantum algorithms for polar decomposition, patch recovery channels, and pretty good measurements. Please.
All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Yihui. I'm from Stanford, and I'm coming to you from Singapore, which is why it's so dark around me. So today I'd like to tell you about a couple of quantum algorithms. Namely, I call them the quantum algorithms for three Ps: polar decomposition, PETS recovery channels, and pretty good measurements. Ooh, how do I? Oh, okay, good, that worked. So this is actually a combination of, I guess, an existing paper on the archive and some newer results. And what unifies these two results is that they both rely on this recent algorithmic toolbox of the quantum singular value transformation. And so using this toolbox, we develop quantum algorithms for two theoretical tools. The first is a tool from classical linear algebra. It's called the polar decomposition. And you can think of this as the matrix analog of expressing a complex number as r times e to the I theta, where r is a real number. So we are also able to implement a tool from quantum information itself, and that's the PETS recovery map. So this is a map that approximately reverses a quantum noise channel. And it surprisingly, I mean, it has some very nice analytical properties, and it has appeared in many areas of physics, which I'm going to tell you about later. So the third P is actually that both of these algorithms lead to an implementation of pretty good measurements, which are another ubiquitous proof tool that we are now able to implement on a quantum computer. So since both of these algorithms rely on a quantum singular value transformation, let's talk a little bit about how that actually works. So the quantum singular value transformation is ultimately about manipulating block encodings. So what's a block encoding? Well, given an arbitrary complex matrix A, a block encoding is a way to write a unitary that has A in its top left-hand corner. So I have that equation there. For now, you can pretend that alpha is equal to 1. So if you can write such a unitary, then this has a physical interpretation in terms of how you can implement A. So equation 1 there is a matter of, I guess, like linear algebra. But now let's talk about the physical implementation or the physical interpretation of this way of writing A. So let's say that you want to apply A to a quantum state psi. And as we know, quantum states can be described by normalized complex vectors. And it might be the case that we want to multiply the complex vector by A. So then what you would do, or the unitary that is a block encoding of A, gives you a way to do this multiplication. So this is how you would do it. First, you enlarge your input state by tensoring it with S and ancillas in the zero state. And then you apply U, which, I mean, U has the correct dimensions. So you apply U to this enlarged input state. And then the second step is to just measure the ancilla. So if the outcome is the all zero state, then you know that the first A qubits contain a state proportional to the transformation that you wanted to make. But of course, in quantum computing, you can't just command your quantum computer to collapse to the state of zero qubits, the state that is all zeros. So we're going to have to do additional amplification to ensure that this post-selection happens. So I'll talk more about that later, but this is basically the core idea. We want to transform a quantum state by A, and the way we do it is we block encode A in a unitary, and then we basically apply the unitary to the quantum state. So the quantum singular value transform is kind of a black box method to do this. So the idea is that if I have a block encoded unitary U, then I want to transform the top left-hand corner of the block encoded unitary into, I want to transform the singular values of its top left-hand block by applying a polynomial to its singular values. And here I have assumed that the top left-hand block is a density matrix, but in general, it doesn't need to be a density matrix. So the idea is that the QSVT is a way of implementing this transformation of the singular values of the top left-hand block. And you can see that the circuit that implements this transformation can be described in a pretty general fashion, namely in like the figure says, you need to alternate your U with some phase gates. So so these phase gates require something called a C pi not gate, but rest assured, that's actually quite a simple gate to apply. So another thing to note is that in general, it suffices to use a polynomial approximation of the function that we actually want to transform the singular values by. And so if we want to transform the singular values by f, then we just find an approximating polynomial and then use this black box to transform the singular values by the approximating polynomial. So this slide makes what I said slightly more rigorous. So let's say that we have a block encoding of some state and we want to transform it using the singular value transform. Then the gate complexity is going to be measured in the number of users of the primitive U, because I showed on the previous slide that the circuit really consists of just alternating U with this like phase gate. And the gate complexity depends on two things, the approximation domain and the error. So this has a slightly more precise definition, but you can see it with a simple example. So let's say that you want to approximate x to the half with a given error. Like, let's say that on the domain between, let's say theta and one, you want the approximation error to be at most delta. And typically we can choose theta to be the minimum singular, one over the minimum singular value of rho. And so the key point is that one over the minimum singular value of rho behaves as what we call a condition number, in the sense that the gate complexity is proportional to this quantity here. And so that's the gate complexity is linear in this condition number, and it's also linear in log one over delta, where delta is like the precision. So now we're going to look at a simple example of how to use a QSBT. And that simple example is going to be the polar decomposition. So just to define things a little bit, let's say that I have a complex matrix A, then I can always factorize it as a unitary times a Hermitian matrix. And the unitary here is called the polar decomposition of A. So like just to remind everyone of what I said a couple of slides ago, you can think of this as the matrix equivalent of writing a complex number in terms of a real number times a phase. And like, I guess the unitary is analogous to the phase. So it actually, I guess I haven't really told you what a polar decomposition is good for, but we'll come to that later. So it's actually useful for many things. So it might be the case that you might want to enact the polar decomposition on an input quantum state, which means that you want to achieve the transformation that I've written down below, which takes psi to U polar of psi. And in general, U polar of psi is not normalized, so you have to add a normalization factor. So here's a quick geometrical intuition for the polar decomposition. It kind of has some similarities to the singular value decomposition. So, first I will talk about the geometrical intuition for the singular value decomposition, which is that if you can decompose A as U psi V T, where U and V are unitaries and sigma is a diagonal matrix, then the accompanying geometrical intuition is that I transform my basis vectors by A and I can decompose this transformation into a rotation, which is VT, a rotation into the standard basis actually, and then a rescaling, which is multiplying by this diagonal matrix sigma, and then a rotation out of the standard basis, which is the final unitary U. So actually you don't really need to go to the standard basis in order to achieve this whole transformation. And polar decomposition actually helps you to save one step. So the polar decomposition is again a rescaling and a rotation, but it saves you one rotation. You don't, you basically just don't have to go you don't have to rotate into the standard basis first. You just immediately do the rescaling in the original basis, and then you rotate from the old basis to the new basis. So in two steps, you can do what you did in three steps for the singular value decomposition. So one application of polar decomposition is this thing called the Procrustes problem. Procrustes. So the origin of this name is kind of gory. It comes from Greek mythology, actually. So Procrustes was a bandit who used to, I guess, like capture people and then like cut off their arms and legs in order to fit them to an iron bed. And I guess like the spirit of this is kind of captured in this mathematical problem, which is that I have R input-output quantum state pairs, and I want to find a unitary that best squashes the set of input quantum states to the set of output quantum states. And essentially, you can solve the optimization problem when you can find that U star is essentially a polar decomposition of some matrices defined in terms of the input and output quantum states. So just to very intuitively and quickly go over our algorithm, this year in June, Lloyd provided an algorithm for enacting the polar decomposition based on some pretty classical tricks. I guess like not classical, but like canonical tricks, density matrix exponentiation, quantum phase estimation. And it turns out that with the quantum singular value transform, this becomes just one line. So you can realize that there is a simple expression for the polar decomposition in terms of the singular value decomposition. And essentially, what you need to do is you need to look at all the singular values of A, and then you just set them to one. And the quantum singular value transform, remember, is a way to transform singular values of block encoded states. So we can do this transformation pretty easily with the QSVT. And it's not only conceptually simpler, but it's also significantly faster than the algorithm in Lloyd. It's exponentially faster in the error, and it also has some polynomial speedups and some other parameters. Okay, so now let's go into the PETS recovery map, which is our second application of the quantum singular value transform and the second P. So this paper is on the archive, so you guys can have a look at that. It's joint work with Andras, Seth, Iman, and Mark. Okay, so now I want to give some intuition as to what this PETS recovery map is. So we can think about classical channels, which are just conditional probability distributions. And the way this classical channel works is that you give it an input probability distribution Px, and then the classical channel transforms it to a new probability distribution Py, which is given by the expression I have there. So you can ask the question, if I know like some input Px and you know Py of x, which is how the channel acts, then what is Px of y? And you can think of, yeah, you can treat this as asking what is the reverse of the channel. And you can obtain Px of y from just Bayes' theorem, just like simply rewriting the probabilities. And we can elevate this to a quantum problem because density matrices are like quantum versions of probability distributions, and quantum channels are like quantum versions of classical channels. So the quantum equivalent of what I've just said is called the PETS recovery map. And the PETS recovery map is a function of two things, a forward channel, N, and the implicit input, sigma. So let's just, settle some notation right now. There are kind of two inputs to the PETS recovery map. One is the implicit input, which is part of the definition of the map. But then once you have defined the map, you can apply it to any input state you want. So these are like two kinds of inputs. So I'll try to be clear which input I'm referring to. Anyway, the PETS recovery map has the expression that I've written down there. And you can see that it already bears some similarities to the classical expression. So Py of x is what is the classical channel, and that is n dagger in the quantum version of the equation. Px is the input probability distribution to the channel, and that is sigma a in the quantum version. And finally, Py is the output of the channel, and that's N sigma A in the quantum version. And indeed, the quantum version reduces to the classical version when your states are diagonal. Okay, so here are just some reasons why you should care about the PETS map as a physicist. So firstly, it's a universal recovery operation in error correction. And secondly, it's an important proof tool in quantum information. And Behghi, Datta, and Leditsky have shown that it can be used as a decoder, which achieves the coherent information rate. The third reason is that it's something a bit more recent, which is that it turns out that the PETS map also has applications in quantum gravity. And this basically boils down to point number one, which is that it's used in error correction. I guess like in quantum gravity, it's related to this phenomenon of entanglement wedge reconstruction, which is the picture I've shown there. And lastly, the types of operations that feature in the PETS map can also be used for quantum Bayesian inference. And this paper by Leifer and Speckens actually defines a whole host of quantum operations that can be viewed as quantum Bayesian inference. And they call it the star product. So what we're about to see may well have applications in implementing other quantum operations. And I guess the last thing is that the PETS map has pretty good measurements as a special case. So I'm going to just give like a 3-slide crash course on quantum information theory so that everyone can approximately be on the same page. So a quantum channel is some kind of physically valid map that brings one quantum state to another quantum state. And an important and practical reason why people study quantum channels is that they serve as a model for quantum noise, such as amplitude damping channels. And the Chuar-Cross theorem is a theorem about how you can write quantum channels. So basically it says that if you have a quantum channel, then you can also write its action on an input state in terms of these cross operators VL. So basically you have like the action of the channel on an input state is a sum over D cross operators, a sum over D terms of the form VL XA VL dagger. And these VLs have to satisfy the condition that if you take the sum over VL dagger VL, that sums to the identity. So we're also going to be using the notion of the channel adjoint. And you guys already saw this when I flashed the equation of the PETS map 2 slides ago. So it's actually part of the definition of the PETS map. So basically, the channel adjoint is a function of a channel, which if you take the inner product of the channel acting on an input state and an arbitrary y, then you can always find some n dagger that acts such that the inner product n dagger y and x is the same as y, as the inner product of y and x. And basically n dagger is the channel adjoint. And the last notion that I wanted to talk about is this notion of an isometric extension of a channel. So you can think of this as the channel version of state purification, namely, just as you can write you can pretend that any mixed state is part of a pure state, you can similarly pretend that every channel is part of an isometry or a unitary. And so the idea is that if you act with this isometry on a larger input space, you first have to tensor in some ancillas to your input state. And you act with this isometric extension of the channel on the enlarged input state. And then finally, you trace out the environment. Then that gives you the action of the original channel. Now, we're going to start talking about how to actually implement the PETS recovery map. But first, let's talk about what input assumptions we have. So we're going to assume that we have the following primitives, or we are able to implement the following quantum circuits. The first is that, like I said, the quantum singular value transform is really a way to manipulate block encodings. So we're going to assume that, well, firstly, we omit the proof, but the process of you can efficiently block encode any density matrices. And we're going to want to block encode two density matrices, namely the implicit input state to the channel, to the patch recovery map, and also the state, the output state of the channel acting on the implicit input state. So we're going to assume that we have block encodings of these two. The second thing is that we're going to want a unitary extension of the forward channel. Okay, I introduced the term isometric extension previously. That's just a more general form of a unitary extension. So basically, we are going to want to implement this purified channel. And I guess this is the reason why it's realistic to assume this is that, like, let's go back to the error correction setting. Let's say that you want to implement the PETS recovery map because you want to use it in error correction, and you somehow manage to characterize your noise, and you're able to simulate it. So if you're able to simulate the noise, you are going to have to simulate it in terms of the unitary extension of the noise. So that's why we assume that we have the unitary extension of the forward channel, which in this case is the noise channel. So now let's look at the PETS recovery map again. So like I said just now, the PETS recovery map is a function of the implicit input state, sigma A, and a quantum channel N. And this equation is what I had a couple of slides ago, which is the quantum version of the Bayes theorem. Okay, so we can actually decompose this into three CP maps. And each of these maps is actually not trace preserving, but overall their composition is trace preserving. So the first map sandwiches the, the arbitrary input state omega b by n sigma a to the minus half. The second CP map applies the channel adjoint to that. And the last CP map sandwiches the output of the second step by sigma a to the half. And we can immediately see that actually the quantum singular value transform will help us perform the minus half and we'll perform the exponents minus half and half in the first step and the third step. So we'll talk more about that later. But before that, let's look more at the second step of the map, which is applying the channel adjoint. So the thing is that we need to rewrite the adjoint a little bit in order to make it implementable. And we're going to rewrite the adjoint in terms of the unitary extension of the channel. And it turns out that you can do so as shown here. So what is this? It means that given an arbitrary input state omega b, if you want to implement the adjoint, you need to tensor in an identity. Then you apply the unitary extension. And then finally, you collapse it. But the thing is that identity is not a quantum state. So the solution is basically just to act on the maximally entangled state. And the density matrix of this maximally entangled state is proportional to the identity. So after doing a bit of rewriting, you will see that the PETS map actually has this expression here. And this expression is to be interpreted as, is to be read from right to left, where the right-hand side is, let me go through this slowly. Okay, so this expression consists again of three steps corresponding to the composition of three CP maps a couple of slides ago. Okay, so the first step was sandwiching the input state by n sigma a to the minus half. And I've highlighted where that corresponds in the expression. The second step is the slightly more complicated step that we had to do the rewriting of. So remember that I said that you have to tensor in a maximally entangled state to your input state. So that's the rightmost block there. And then also, because we had to rewrite the channel adjoint, so that results in the application of UN dagger and also the final pole selection on E prime. And then finally, the last step is the sandwiching by sigma a to the half, and that's in green. And you'll notice something a little bit Okay, well, not yet. Okay, so the final thing is that what we're actually going to do is we're going to implement an isometric extension of the pets map. So that was the expression that I have, I had at first. And then once you implement the isometric extension and you can finally trace over the environment, and this will implement the map. So I'm going to present the theorem which describes the gate complexity and the error. So basically the pet's recovery map, again, is a function of the forward channel and an implicit input state sigma A. And we're going to want to realize an approximation in Diamond norm of the pet's recovery map of epsilon. And we're going to count the number of uses of our block encodings. So, and the reason we write it like that is because like you may have your own ways of implementing the block encoding. So we just want to make this theorem as general as possible. And the key point is to focus on the number of uses of the of UN, which is a block encoding of, which is an isometric extension of the channel. And the number of uses of this is square root DE times kappa, where DE is the dimension of the environment system, which is at least the cross rank of the channel. And kappa is the condition number of the output state of the channel. And although I won't really go into the argument, it turns out that this number of uses of UN is practically optimal. And well, the argument, to summarize it in one line, relies on Grover's search. Okay, so now let's look more carefully at how to implement the pets recovery map.
Sorry, can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Just on the previous slide.
Yeah.
Do you know what, like, can one know what kappa is or bound it beforehand or use it away?
Because in general, when you want to define the pets recovery channel, you already know what the input state and the forward channel are. So then you can calculate kappa ahead of time. Yeah, so kappa is again, 1 over the minimum singular value of n sigma. And if you know n and you know sigma, you can compute kappa. All right. Okay, so now I go into a bit more details of how to implement the map. So actually the first and the third maps are simply a matter of transforming the block encodings. So the first map is a matter of, so we have assumed that we have a block encoding of n sigma, and we simply use the quantum singular value transform to multiply all its singular values by minus half, to take all its singular values to the power of minus half. And the gate complexity of this is kappa n sigma. Now the third map is in green, and that is the map that sandwiches the state by sigma a to the half. And we can implement a map that does that by taking a block encoding of sigma a. We assume that we had such a block encoding. And then we use the quantum singular value transform, again, to transform this block encoding by taking all its singular values to the power of half. And again, the gate complexity of this is kappa sigma uses of u sigma, which is the primitive that we assumed that we had. So now we know how to do maps 1 and 3. The final thing
can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
To the previous slide. So here you're hiding the polynomial approximation of the functions, right? So the delta from before, I think, the log one over delta.
Indeed, that's why I put an old tilde. Indeed, you have a log one over delta term.
That's in the tilde, okay.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, are there any more questions, by the way?
Oh yeah, I have a question. So you mentioned that the Pets recovery map is the quantum version of a classical, this Bayesian thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the complexity for the classical map, like classical recovery map? Would it be some kind of square root the size of the Y register or something like that?
Oh, that's a really excellent question. So the algorithm that we have implements a perfectly general Pets recovery map, but as we know, the Pets recovery map reduces to the classical case. Mm-hmm. And it may well be that the complexity is much simpler for implementing the classical version of this. But we haven't explored that in at least the version of the paper that's currently on the archive. And we hope to explore that in an upgraded paper that will probably appear at some point.
I see. So it could be, you could get a speed up for the classical recovery as well.
Yeah, that may be.
Okay.
We would have to look at what other ways there are to implement the classical version as well. So, yeah, not sure. Yeah, and actually, just to add on to that comment, I guess like in the example I'm going to show later, the PETS recovery map actually gives you a general algorithm for implementing general pretty good measurements. But we found that in a special case of pretty good measurements, you can actually speed up this algorithm by some polynomial, by polynomial in some of the parameters. So it really seems quite probable that if you look at a special case of the PETS recovery map, you're going to find a speed up. And I guess like a simple case where you can immediately see a speed up is that the PETS recovery map of a unitary is just the inverse of that unitary. So like you don't need all this complicated machinery, right? It's just going to be super simple.
Right. Thanks.
Okay, so let's move on if there are no other questions. So we talked about how to implement map 1 and map 3. Now we are going to talk about how to implement map 2, which is the channel adjoint. So the channel adjoint is highlighted in yellow. I guess like part of it is highlighted in yellow. So just to remind everyone, the first thing you have to do is that you have to tensor in to your input state, the maximally entangled state gamma. And then you're going to want to perform UN dagger after you do map number 1. So both of these steps are very easy. You don't need a quantum singular value transform. But the thing is that so you have to implement map number 3, which corresponds to the sigma to the half, because there's like a gap between the step number 2 here and like the step 1 and steps 3 and 4. And in that gap, you have to implement sigma a to the half. Okay, and after you do that, then you're going to have to do the last yellow blob, which is to measure the system E prime and accept if the all zeros outcome occurs. And finally, you're going to also want to ignore the system E tilde, but that's that's very simple. Just ignore it. So we can, so here I say that, actually steps 3 and 4 are actually not contiguous with steps 1 and 2. We need to implement map number 3 first, which is sigma a to the half. So now we assume that we have performed map number 3, and I'm going to talk about how to do the measurement which accepts if the all zero outcome occurs. Okay, so the thing is that you're going to want to apply some amplification. If we follow the prescription, I guess a more detailed version of the prescription that I have on the previous slides, we are eventually going to have implemented the unitary W tilde, which in its top left-hand block has the ideal PETS map, but also kind of a normalization factor. Okay, so this is a probabilistic implementation, and you can just work out that the normalization factor actually gives you the probability of success, or the square root of the probability of success of getting zero if you measure the E prime system. Okay, and as with all good quantum algorithms, if you want to boost the probability of success, you have to use amplitude amplification. And in this case, we choose to use oblivious amplitude amplification, which is just amplitude amplification where you don't need to know the initial state. This is kind of like, amplitude amplification is kind of like a generalization of Grover. So you can see that the familiar 1 over square root of p success gate complexity of Grover is also characterizing this amplitude amplification step. And finally, if you put together all the complexities, you're going to get what I had in the theorem statement a couple of slides ago. All right, so now we're going to talk about an application of algorithms, namely pretty good measurements. Okay, so let me just give some background on what pretty good measurements are. So if you have an ensemble of mixed states and a quantum state rho that you are promised is in one of the states with probability px, then you want to maximize your probability of correctly identifying exactly which state rho is, which member of the ensemble corresponds to rho. And it turns out that there is no optimal strategy when you have more than three candidate states. But a pretty good measurement actually does pretty well on this, in the sense that if you apply the pretty good measurement to on your ensemble of states, if you apply the pretty good measurement on rho, then you're going to get a probability of correctly identifying rho that is at most quadratically worse than the optimal success probability. And a pretty good measurement is actually a special case of the PETS map. With, like I said, the PETS map is a function of this implicit input state and a channel. And with some specific choices of these two inputs, of these two input arguments, you're going to get the pretty good measurement. And because we have an algorithm for implementing the PETS map, our algorithm naturally translates to an application of pretty good measurements. And the gate complexity is basically square root of the number of options you have, and also polynomial in the condition number. So it turns out that you can actually speed this up. So this is what I was talking about just now. Let's say that all your options are pure states and you have a uniform distribution over these pure states. So this is a special case. It's not the most general thing you could do with pretty good measurements, but it's actually not such an uncommon setting. And this setting was considered by Olevo in 1979. So just to very quickly compare the two algorithms, we again have to define a condition number, which is 1 over the minimum singular value of this particular matrix here. And it turns out that the two parameters, the two relevant parameters are the number of options you have, R, and the condition number. And the PETS map algorithm can implement this like pretty good measurement for the special case with R squared kappa cubed uses of U phi. U phi is some kind of state preparation unitary. And the polar decomposition algorithm is actually also able to handle this case, but polynomially faster. So with R kappa uses of U phi. Okay, so I'm going to just end off with several reasons why you should care about the pretty good measurements. So the first is that it's actually used to approach the Olevo information rate in quantum Shannon theory. And another reason is that because of its nice properties of being an optimal measurement to distinguish states, the pretty good measurement actually appears in a lot of proofs. And some examples are in quantum algorithms, it's often used to prove some bounds on sample complexity or basically used to prove optimality of your quantum algorithm. And also in a recent paper, I think Felix also showed that it's optimal for port-based teleportation. So this pretty good measurement stuff is really quite ubiquitous. So I'm going to conclude now. Okay, so basically the quantum singular value transform is a way of allowing us to implement some theoretical tools in a way that is systematic, rigorous, and fast. We showed two algorithms. The first algorithm is one for polar decomposition. This is a new tool for quantum linear algebra in the sense that it's implementing linear algebra on quantum states. And secondly, this polar decomposition algorithm also allows us to speed up pretty good measurements for a certain special case. The second algorithm that we showed was an algorithm for PETS recovery maps and general purpose PGM. And this is described more in the archive that I linked. And the reason why this algorithm is cool is because these theoretical tools are now brought closer to implementation with this rigorous algorithm to implement them. And secondly, it turns out that this implementation that we have is almost optimal in gate complexity. And that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Thanks a lot for that talk. Very interesting. Yeah, any questions? I have one to the pretty good measurement part. So this algorithm based on the polity composition only works for pure states.
Yeah, it only works for pure states.
Is there a simple explanation why it doesn't work for mixed states?
Well, basically, it's not that it doesn't work for mixed states. It's more like we don't know how to write it for mixed states. It's basically you have to look at how so it goes through the Procrastes problem. And the Procrastes problem is a way of, I guess it's like finding a unitary that maps like pure states to pure states. So you can think of that as like being why our algorithm, or why we don't know how to write this algorithm for mixed states. Yeah, it may be possible to do it, but we haven't really thought about it.
Okay.
So it looks like for the mixed state, you on one hand seem to have simultaneous conditions on the different eigenstates for the density matrix that you want to transform. On the other hand, you don't need to specifically map one pure state to another. You can scramble around between the different component in your mixed state. So I can see that it can go either way. If there is a simple solution, I can see that it can be harder or easier. It's kind of funny.
Actually, I'm not really sure what you mean.
instead of thinking of mapping one pure state to another and then doing it for a number of them, when you have mixed states, it seems that you don't need to make sure that each eigenstate in the density matrix have to map to the final, like, I would think about it as a mixture of pure state, right? If you have it's a mixture of pure state when you have a mixed state as the in the ensemble. And it looks like how you manage the mixture, it gives you more conditions to look at on one hand, but on the other hand, there's a relaxation there because you don't necessarily need to make sure that each pure state component go to a certain thing. You can mix up within that mixture inside the density matrix.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting. I think basically the idea for using the polar decomposition is basically just this observation that for the special case of pure states, it's very straightforward to write it as the Procrastes problem because the Procrastes problem doesn't have an arbitrary probability distribution over the input and output states. So I guess that's one of the reasons why it's like more straightforward to see that the Procrastes problem leads to an implementation of the PGM for just pure states and uniform probability distributions. I would need to think about whether you can do it for mixed states as well.
Sorry, just as a reminder, the Procrastes problem is you have a collection of pure states, two collections of pure states, and you want to find a unitary that maps one set to the other.
And the minimal
error or something. Or
indeed. So you want minimum L2 error, I think.
Okay. And it's proven that the polar decomposition, the U in the polar decomposition, is the optimal thing.
It is the optimal. Yes, it's provable.
I think that particular state transformation. I think some other researchers call it quantum splitting.
The quantum what?
Quantum splitting.
Ah, okay.
And one of my colleagues at CNO, and maybe some visitors, Zhu Kong Li and others, have looked at that problem at some point. Just in case it has anything useful, I'll forward through the names and
right.
So on so that you can take a look. It may not be relevant, but just in case.
Okay, thanks so much. That'll be very helpful.
I have one more question. So there are these generalizations of the pretty good measurement where you allow any power in the state, like when you write down the defining relation. For example, the square measurement is very well known as well. How does the complexity change when you have powers there?
I think actually if you wanted to implement one of these generalizations, the powers would probably be pretty easy to do with the quantum singular value transform. You would just need to find a polynomial approximation of the powers.
I see, in case it's not an integer power.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Yehui again for a nice talk.
All right.
Which kind of concludes the official part of this.
Is there an unofficial part?
Depending on what people want to do, we can hang around here in a meeting. I mean, for you, it's midnight right now, right?
It's a bit late here, so I would love to hang around, but unfortunately, it is not really conducive because my group meeting is at 7:30 a.m. tomorrow. So.
Okay, it's challenging with different time zones, I guess, right? Yeah. Of course, feel free to just log off at any point. Like, you don't need to.
Yeah.
The rest of us can have the usual group lunch on Wednesday.
Right, which would happen now, actually, if things were normal. Exactly.
Well, I just wanted to say that if anyone has any questions, please feel free to email me. My email is in this, I guess it's in the CC, in the email that Felix sent. So thanks for being a great audience and some really great questions. And sadly, I have to leave, but I will join you in spirit for lunch.
Sounds good. Thanks for the talk.